So once again, we've completed our Saturday morning Brahma Samhita recital, which is a yajna for the pleasure of Krishna. So what we do at this point, we usually talk about a little bit about some of the Brahma Samhita that we just read. And if anyone has any question or, you know, so we read it in English. If anyone has a particular verse that we wish to discuss, I'm calling for volunteers.
The verse on that one verse which I read, like I saw here, that Lord ordains without any partiality the works of fruit,
yeah,
of the smallest ant and the name.
Yes, Twindra Gopa Matavendra Mahoswa Karma Bandhanu Rupa Palabhajana Matunoti.
Yeah. And also, like, for a person who is performing devotion service, he removes the result of karma. So yeah. Can you explain on that?
Yeah. So let's read that verse. It's verse number 54. Yes, it's on page 98. Yas twindra gopam atavendra mahoswa karma bandhanu rupa palabhajanam atanoti karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajan govindam adipurushang tamahang bhajami. I adore, let's read the word for words. Yah, he who. Why don't we repeat them? So I say them, you repeat. To, but, Indragopam, to the small red insect called Indragopa, Atava, or even, Indram, to Indra, king of heaven, Aho, O, Swakarma, of one's own fruit of activities. Bandha, bondage. Anurupa, according to. Pala, of reactions. Bhajanam, enjoying or suffering. Atanoti, bestows. Karmani, of all fruit of activities and their reactions. Nirdahati, destroys. Kintu, but, cha, also, bhakti bhajan, of persons engaged in devotional service. Govindam, Govinda, Adi Purusham, the original person. Tam, him, aham, I, bhajami, worship. Translation, I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who burns up to their roots all fruit of activities of those who are imbued with devotion, and impartially ordains for each the due enjoyment of the fruits of one's activities of all those who walk in the path of work, in accordance with the chain of their previously performed works, no less in the case of the tiny insect that bears the name of Indragopa than in that of Indra, king of the Devas. Purport. God impartially induces the fallen souls to act in the way that is consequent on the deeds of their previous births and to enjoy the fruition of their labors. But out of his great mercy to his devotees, he purges out by the fire of ordeal the root of all karma, namely nescience and evil desires. Karma, though without beginning, is still perishable. The karma of those who work with the hope of enjoying the fruits of their labors becomes everlasting and endless and is never destroyed. The karma of those who work with the hope of enjoying the fruits of their labors becomes everlasting and endless and is never destroyed. I don't understand that sentence, because I thought of all the things, of all the five subjects of Bhagavad Gita, karma was the thing that was not eternal. There's time is eternal, and the soul is eternal, and the Paramatma is eternal, and the material energy itself is eternal, but karma is not eternal. So I'm having trouble with that sentence. The function...
How to understand is this,
just for the lifetime. It lasts beyond the lifetime. But I'm sorry, go ahead. Why don't you take the microphone and explain what your point is? I'm sorry. That's why we use the microphone, is that people are watching on the internet.
Oh, okay.
And we're making a broadcast. So we can't hear you without the microphone. So
this particular sentence, how I understood is that karma is when you keep on doing the activities and when you keep on enjoying the fruits, you are bound within this within the modes of material nature. And this is only applicable as long as you are keep on doing the activities and enjoying the fruits of their labor. That means that keeps on going means that is valid before you start the process of akarma. That means that is eternal, that keeps on going before till you start the process of akarma. That is how I understood it.
That might be the best way to understand it. That is saying that unless you start the process of devotional service, then you're going to keep in the cycle of karma forever.
Yeah.
That's probably it. But your actual activities are here today, gone tomorrow. You know, today you're a soldier, next life you may be a farmer, and the following life you may be an accountant. The function of sannyas is also a sort of karma befitting an ashrama, and is not pleasant to Krishna when it aims at liberation, i.e. desire for emancipation. They also receive fruition of their karma, and even if it be disinterested, their karma ends in atma mamata, that is, self-pleasure. But those who are pure devotees always serve Krishna by gratifying his senses, forsaking all attempts of karma and jnana, and being freed from all desires save that of serving Krishna. Krishna has fully destroyed the karma, its desires and nescience of those devotees. It is a great wonder that Krishna, being impartial, is fully partial to his devotees. Actually, this is a wonderful verse, and it's very pertinent to the verse of the Bhagavatam we'll be reading today, because we're reading about the birth of Emperor Parikshit and how he was born at a time when the constellations were just auspicious for the birth of a great personality in that time and place. And so it's talking about this whole concept of karma and free will. And so this verse is really amazing, that it's showing that there's two separate things going on. There's the soul and there's the body. And in the world of the material body, not just the gross material body, but also the subtle body and everything, there's laws of nature, cause and effect. It's the mundane scientists also, although they don't understand the subtle material nature, they're interested in the causes and effects in gross matter, and they have this prejudice actually that the material world is a causally closed system, that there can't be anything that doesn't, everything that happens is the effect of some cause and is the cause of some other effect, and there's nothing outside that system. In other words, there's no soul, there's no God. They don't admit in the material, the method of material empirical science doesn't admit to the existence of a causeless cause, of something outside the system of the cause and effect. And so they have the traditional problem in Western philosophy is, if you believe in a soul, they say, well, you can't explain how the soul is connected to the body. The mind-body problem is what you can't explain how a soul can actually have will and can do something that affects what the body does. And so what they end up saying, very similar to the Buddhists, is they say there is no self, really. The conception that we have of ourself, of our continuing self, that once I was in a baby's body and now I'm the same person in a grown-up body, and there is no free will. In other words, everything is just chemicals, and the chemicals are, we're studying the causes and effects of physics and chemistry, and that really explains all of our activities and all our poetry and romance, and all those things are just explained by chemicals. There was, who was it? Poincaré? I think it was Henri Poincaré, the French mathematician and scientist who had basically invented statistical mechanics, and he got an audience with Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, and he explained to Bonaparte that if we knew this sense of determinism is now not accepted by quantum physics. This was, you know, the beginning of the 19th century. He said, if we knew the vector, the position and the speed and direction of every particle in the universe, you know, by this kind of Newtonian mechanics of knowing how particles move and interact, he says, if we had enough time, you know, if we had a brain big enough to calculate, we could explain the entire past, present and future of the universe because of knowing how all the particles are interacting. So Napoleon said, well then, where is the place for, in this view of the world, where is the place for God in this view of the world? And Poincaré said, sire, we have no need of that hypothesis. So this is the atheistic tendency of science. It's really just an assumption, and I think historians will at some point come to see that, you know, this was just a particular stage that human philosophy was going through, that it became frustrated with sort of superstitious belief in religion that wasn't backed by solid philosophy, and the technological advancements of learning mechanics, physics, chemistry, and all these by the method of studying material nature through empirical experimentation and cooperative efforts at making theories that explain and preserve the appearances, gives us something tangible in the form of technology that we can say, ah, this is knowledge. But it's really just an assumption that it's a causally closed system and that there's no soul and that there's no God, or that to admit that there's no soul, to admit that there was a soul and there's free will would be like admitting magic into the system, which they don't accept. In the same way, when Newton, you know, started teaching that there was a universal gravitation and that all matter was attracted to each other, you know, based on this formula, the inverse square law, you know, there's a universal gravitational constant, and the square of the distance between the it's proportional to the square of the distance between two pieces of matter, and there's something called mass, and it's attracting. At that time, the people were Cartesians. The modern physics of the day was thought that the universe was a plenum. There wasn't any empty space and everything. I'm sorry if I'm getting too conflict, but they thought that the idea of action at a distance was magical, and therefore was an occult force. And so it took some time for Newtonianism to be accepted because of the idea that they were getting rid of astrology, they were getting rid of alchemy, they were getting rid of all these things, and saying, no, we have to explain everything by one object, imposing a force on another object through physical contact. And so the idea that objects were contacting each other from a distance was considered by the Cartesians to be unscientific. And so now the idea that there's a soul and that there's a super soul in everyone's heart, and that that the experience that meditators on Krishna have of bliss and happiness and clarity also and fearlessness, all those things. The modern scientists currently have this prejudice to try to explain it all in terms of but it has to be explained in a mechanical way in terms of the physics. Now our physics has had to accept action at a distance, gravity, it's had to accept field theory and, you know, electromagnetism, it's had to accept in, you know, relativity and quantum mechanics, it's had to accept some other inconceivable concepts, including even the multidimensional world theories and you know, the Schrodinger's, you know, that the world is not determinate at all. You can't say where a particular small particle is in any place. It's just a probability. And, you know, there's all these other things that they're doing. And someday I think they'll be able to accept, they should be able to accept that there is this other side of life, which is spiritual. But anyway, I've gotten a little far afield from this, but there is, nevertheless, there are material laws that govern all our actions. And the actions we do today, even the actions we do today, are caused by unseen factors in previous actions in previous lives. There has to be an explanation. If they say there's a cause for everything, but they don't see that there can be subtle causes, it seems like magic to them. But, you know, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that according to the modes of nature we associate with, we go from body to body. Here, please hand me a Bhagavad Gita. That we go from body to body, like the air carries aromas. At the time of death, we leave one body and we achieve another body. Thank you. Just according to the nature that we've acquired. And here, chapter 15, the Yoga of the Supreme Person. He says, in verses 8, 9, and 10, the living entity in the material world carries his different conceptions of life from one body to another as the air carries aromas. Thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. The living entity, thus taking another gross body, obtains a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, and sense of touch, which are grouped about the mind. He thus enjoys a particular set of sense objects. The foolish cannot understand how a living entity can quit his body, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. But one whose eyes are trained in knowledge can see all this. And he goes on in the next verse to say, the endeavoring transcendentalists who are situated in self-realization can see all this clearly. But those whose minds are not developed and who are not situated in self-realization cannot see what is taking place, though they may try to. The other day, I don't know, do you know, devotee, do you know who Satyaraj is? Stephen Rosen, Satyaraj Das? He's a devotee in New York, a scholarly devotee that has written many, many books. He also is the editor of the Journal of Vaishnava Studies. And he has, really developed a career as an intellectual just out of being a devotee, being a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. He hasn't gone and gotten a PhD, or I don't even think he went to college. But he publishes many, many books on many subjects, philosophy, history. In fact, the sometimes we distribute a book called The Hidden Glory of India. Have you seen that book? And he's the author of that book. But he's written books on, you know, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, the Vaishnava saints, all different, many kinds of subjects. So he wrote me the other day, and he said, I was honored that he wrote me, and he asked me, can you write, I'm working on a writing project, can you send me a couple short paragraphs on why it is that Krishna consciousness is a science? And I, you know, I wrote him that it's not science in the sense of the empirical, you know, scientific method of hypothesis and experimentation that can disprove the hypotheses and all these things, but it's a science in that it's factual knowledge about reality. It's a great system. It can be learned. It can be mastered. Those who are masters of it, they can recognize other masters, and they can train others to see things this way. So here, it's logically coherent, although it has an analysis, a sophisticated analysis of the limits of logic and the limits of sense perception. And it, you know, depends on having direct perception of the absolute truth by purifying the consciousness through bhakti. But here Krishna is talking about how, you know, this is science. This knowledge is knowledge about how the soul takes birth in a particular body. How one person is born on a battlefield. I was out doing the Motel Gita in Nashville, Tennessee. Dilip Patel and I went down to Nashville, Tennessee to do the Motel Gita. And some of our former devotees here that used to live here and now they're living in Tennessee, they came to help us. And their 11-year-old son was there helping us at our table distribute Bhagavad Gitas to motels, to place in motel rooms the way they do Gideon Bibles and things. And come on in. Hare Krishna, welcome. Ananda Rupa. So I was talking to some Christian woman, and she was upset that Hindus believe in karma. You know, she was being trained to be a missionary and go convert Hindus to Christianity. And she was arguing that the idea of karma keeps lower classes down because they accept, oh, this is just my karma that I was born in this family, and so they don't feel that they have to struggle against the privileged classes and gain their rights that I'm equal to you and things like that. So she was criticizing the idea of karma. And this 11-year-old boy was so intelligent. And he told her, well, then how do you explain that someone is born on a battlefield and someone else is born with a silver spoon in his mouth? He had that phrase. I don't know where he heard that phrase. How do you explain that someone is born? Why is someone born this way and someone else born that way? And of course, the mundane scientist view of things is, well, it's just chemicals and physics and accident. There is no real, those things that we perceive of as intention, emotion, will, all the attributes of human beings and everything, even in, like I said, in art and poetry, music and things like that, it doesn't really exist in reality, or it's what they call it an epiphenomenon, that it has no causal. It's causally emergent is the word. These are words philosophers use. It has no causal influence. It doesn't actually change what's going on in the world. You might think, well, it does, because I like this music. I go to the record store and I buy that music. And they say, that's how we perceive it, but that's not what really is going on. The reason we have the sense of liking the music and all those things is just, and the sense of being conscious even, the sense of being able to have an internal character of experiencing, you know, what, like, describe what chocolate tastes like to somebody else. You can't do it unless they have to taste it. And how do you know that it tastes the same to you as it tastes to them? All these are questions that philosophers talk about, and they struggle with it because they're materialists and they can't accept that we have individual souls and that these actual qualities like the taste of chocolate are qualities in nature, you know. Anyway, I'm getting too far afield into this philosophy, but that is because of their karma, because of their past deeds. Some person takes birth in one family, some person takes birth in another family. Some person is born mentally retarded, and some person is born a child prodigy genius. And it's all due to the modes of material nature that the soul is associating with in this endless cycle of causes and effects, that the work we do and the deeds we do now, we're impelled to do them because of the deeds we did in the past, the impulse of previous impressions, as it says in the Brahma Samhita, and it creates this great chain. And yet there is a scope for free will in all this, but it's not as free as we think it is. But there is free will. That it's like when you buy a ticket. You have to, and you get on an airplane, and you go to Mumbai. You know, you're gonna go there. You're gonna end up there. Whether you know, once you're on the plane, you can't get off. Otherwise, you'd have to be flying out into the atmosphere. So you're gonna go there. But in the meantime, there's things you can do while you're on the plane. You know, you could decide to watch the movie or read your book or whatever, do a crossword puzzle. So there's things you can do. So that, you know, we have things that we have to experience. In the Puranas, Padma Purana, it's described that karma unfolds like it's compared to a plant, that when you perform some deed, either a pious deed or a sinful deed, it creates a seed of a reaction. And that seed, at first, it stays in a dormant state as a seed. It doesn't even appear in your mind or in your subconscious or anything. And then it sprouts. And the sprouts develop branches and twigs, and eventually they develop fruits and flowers, which are the prarabdha, the manifest karma that you're experiencing currently in terms of pleasures and pains and things happening to you. But in the sprouting stage and the stage of branching out and things like that, then there's thoughts, desires, predilections, all these things that make up the subtle things that make up your personality and your unconscious personality. And so there's so much karma. There's so many impressions that we've had over millions and billions of lives from ever, and they're all influencing us in different ways. And this is all causing what we are and what we do today. But there is a way out, and that is devotional service. And that devotional service is so powerful that it burns up to their roots the karma. It burns the seeds. This is described in the beginning of the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Shukadeva Goswami was testing Parikshit Maharaj a little bit and saying, well, you know, you can get free from sins by atoning for them and performing some prayashchitta. But Parikshit Maharaj was intelligent enough to say, no, even though you can atone for the sins and you get free from the later reaction that you would get from that sin, then you haven't gotten rid of the desire deep down, the seed that causes you to commit sins again. And he described it as the bathing of an elephant. That, you know, an elephant goes in the water and he sprays his back, but then he goes on land and he throws sand on his back, you know. So what good is the bath? He's taking a bath and getting rid of the dirt, but then he comes out and he puts dirt on himself, because it's the same activity, throwing stuff on your back. So the example is given that, you know, a pious person goes to church and repents for his sins and gets some and says some atonements, gives some donation and says some prayers to atone and get forgiven for the sin. But it becomes a business. It's just the essence of it is I'm trying to enjoy, I'm trying to avoid suffering, and I'm doing all these things to enjoy, and I'm doing these things to avoid suffering. And so the seed is still existing in the sense of that mentality that I'm the enjoyer and life is about satisfying me to enjoy. And in the purport here, Bhaktisiddhanta is saying that even the desire for liberation of the impersonalists who through jnana, try to understand what is eternal, what isn't eternal, and stop acting. How do we stop acting? We can't stop acting. As long as we have a body, we can't stop acting. Krishna says in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita that sarvaik prakriti jaya gunai. No one can refrain from doing anything for a minute. Everybody is being... The Bhagavad Gita deals with karma and karma yoga to quite an extent. And in the third chapter, Nahi kaschit kshanamapi jatu tishtatya karma krit karyate hyabashak karma sarvak prakriti jayar gunahi. Everyone is forced to act helplessly according to the qualities he has acquired from the modes of material nature. Therefore, no one can refrain from doing something, not even for a moment. You might say, well, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to sit still. But sitting still is doing something. And while you're sitting still, you're still breathing, right? You're still thinking. there's other things that you're doing. So Krishna is saying, karmanya karma yak pashed akarmanicha karma yak sabudhi man manasheshu suyukta kritsna karma krit. He's talking about one can see. The real way to stop doing anything is to stop identifying yourself as the doer and understand that you are the soul, which is which has its own activities which are not material. They're outside of the realm of the cause and effect of material nature. And those activities are devotional service. So Krishna explains that in the Bhagavad Gita. How to stop doing something. It doesn't mean you don't fight the battle of Kurukshetra. You fight the battle of Kurukshetra, but you do so as devotional service and not with the intention to become a conquering king and then you'll be happy. You know, your happiness lies in pleasing Krishna. And as soon as you understand that, then the seed of karma even is destroyed. That seed of still identifying yourself as something other than a servant of Krishna. And Bhaktisiddhanta is saying here that the function of sannyas is also a sort of karma befitting an ashram, right? To become externally a sannyasi, that's another kind of work, actually. You could say, okay, now I'm no longer an enjoyer, I'm going to renounce everything. But renunciation is also one of the four ashramas, right? There's varnas and ashramas, and one of the ashramas it's part of that varnashrama system of work. And you could say, well, it's not fruit of work because I'm giving up everything. But you're still doing it for some purpose, and what is that purpose? He's saying, if the purpose is to realize that you are Brahman and you're not material, you're not this body, but you're Brahman. But if you don't know how to act as Brahman, you're still. He says, the function of sannyas is also, it's not pleasant to Krishna when it aims at liberation. That is desire for emanciation. They also receive fruition of their karma, and even if it be disinterested, their karma ends in atma mamata, i.e. self-pleasure. But those who are pure devotees always serve Krishna. So what he's saying is the desire for liberation is even still a desire to identify with something which is not a servant of Krishna. You want to say, okay, now I'm not an enjoyer of material nature, but then what am I? Well, I'm the unlimited. That's not what you really are. What you really are is a servant of Krishna. Yes, you're not material nature, you're spiritual nature, but you're not the sum total of all spiritual nature. You're just a tiny fragment of spiritual nature. And the sum total of all spiritual nature, that is Krishna. And devotional service to Krishna is the only thing that destroys all karma completely. Ye nye ravindakshav, Lord Brahma prays in the 10th canto, ye nye ravindakshav vimukta maninas toyashta bhavada avishuddha buddhaya aruya kritshtrena parang padang tatak padantyadho anadrita yusmarangraya. He says, even those who think themselves liberated, Krishna, if they haven't accepted your lotus feet, they fall down again. Lotus-eyed Krishna, they have to accept your lotus feet. Otherwise, their intelligence is still impure. So even the stage of liberation, Brahma-bhuta, if it doesn't go further into devotional service, mad-bhakti-lapate-param, if it just remains in the stage of identifying, oh, I'm not matter, I am Brahman, then you haven't received the finishing touch that really finally ends all karma. And again, because the soul is by nature active, if you don't proceed further to bhakti, then at some point you will proceed again to material activities. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example of that people become famous, impersonalists become famous as liberated persons, but then what do? They start mundane welfare societies, hospitals and schools and things to help mundane welfare, which is nice in and of itself. Mundane welfare is pious activity, but it's material activity. What's the point of doing mundane welfare? If you're really not this body and you have nothing to do with this material activity, then why be engaged in mundane welfare? And if you actually should be engaged in devotional service. And, you know, part of your devotional service may be, if it's your occupation, like Lord Brahma's devotional service had an occupation. Haribola Pramaya Prabhu. You know, he had an occupation to create the material universe. So you, part of your occupation may be that you may be a school superintendent or a hospital administrator or someone running a charitable society or whatever. But the goal of everything has to be to please Krishna. Otherwise, what's the point of all those other things? And if you can please Krishna, if you can actually realize Krishna and give that realization to other people, that's the real welfare work. Without that, any other welfare work is just like saving the coat and shirt of a man who's drowning, right? He's drowning and you save his coat and shirt. You think you're doing something good for them, but it's just more within the realm of karma, you know, bandhanu rupa. Krishna says, yagyartat karmano nyatra loko yang karma bandhana. Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed. Otherwise, work causes bondage in this material world. Anyatra loko yam karma bandhana. Other than yagya, all work is just the cause of some other reaction and some other work. It's stuck in this material conception. But karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajam. Those who are engaged in works of devotional service, then all karma is destroyed. This is the way to finally become free from karma by stopping identifying with oneself as the enjoyer and stopping oneself as identifying as the body. Have I fully answered? So let's sing a song about